Hello, and welcome to the Community Mennonite Church Podcast. This week's sermon is brought to us by Pastor Dana Olson Getty.
Please pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be pleasing in your sight, O God, our rock and our Redeemer King. Amen. Nearly 1,000 years before Mary of Nazareth gave birth to her firstborn on the dirt floor of a borrowed animal shelter and put him to sleep in a feed crate, King David of Israel decided that he would build God a palace. We heard this story a little earlier in the service. Art read it to us. David was only Israel's second king, but he had done really well by himself. And at this point in his life, he had battled and beaten or killed off all his rivals. He could rest easy in his capital city, in his power and his wealth. He lived in an elegant mansion made of imported Lebanese cedar. And he lived there with his many beautiful wives and children. As a way to fortify his reign over Israel, he had brought the Ark, the symbol of God's presence, to live with him in the capital city. But David gets to thinking. He tells Nathan the prophet, "This just doesn't seem quite right. I'm living in this luxurious and secure home, while God, the Ark, is still living outside in a tent. Surely God would also appreciate a cedar-framed palace." Now, God seems to sense that this offer of a palace comes with some mixed motives. Maybe God can see that David is really more interested in promoting his own brand and reputation as a builder of impressive religious arenas. Or maybe God could see that David was intrigued by this idea of building an elaborate box for God, something that would somewhat curb God's wildness or curtail God's freedom, a place where God would always be whenever David had a request to make. Or maybe God could see what it would cost God's people to build a lavish temple. In fact, this is a temple that David's son Solomon did build, and it required the enslavement of the people through forced labor and burdensome taxes in order to build a building to honor the God who had brought them out of slavery. "You think you're going to build me a house?" God says. "No way! I am going to build you a house." Now, this house that God is promising to David, it's not a physical house, it's a dynasty, a household, a succession of royal heirs that stretches down through time, a monarchy that never ends. And unlike the previous covenants God had made with people, in this covenant, God says, even if your descendants fail me, even if they are disobedient and turn their backs on me, still, my promise will remain unbroken forever. So flash forward 1,000 years. Mary and her people are living under military occupation, under the occupation of the vast and powerful Roman Empire. It's been 1,000 years since God made this promise to David, and it's been 500 years since the Babylonians destroyed the temple in Jerusalem and took the very last descendants of King David, who had any power at all, into captivity in Babylon. And so, Mary and her people are living under King Herod. He's just one in a long procession of greedy and violent dictators. He's a ruthlessly ambitious man, self-made. He's wrangled his way up the ladder and found a way to manipulate himself into being appointed by the Roman emperor to rule over all of Judea on the emperor's behalf. So Herod maintains the pretense of being a practicing Jew. That's politically astute in his time and place. But he also covers all his bases by building temples for Greek and Roman gods. And he's known for two things. One, he's a violent, unpredictable, paranoid man who is willing to sacrifice anyone, including his wives and children, to protect his own power. And two, he's a builder. Year after year, he undertakes these astonishingly ambitious and elaborate building projects. Modern engineers are still astounded by some of the things he accomplished. We don't even know how he would do them with our contemporary machinery and tools. He built fortresses, palaces, a deep water port, aqueducts, roads, and he used all of these building projects to strengthen his political and military power. But as with all building projects, he had to pay for them. And in order to pay for them, he increased the taxes on Palestine's already poor peasants and forced many of them to work for months at a time as unpaid laborers on these building projects. And as with many empires, the wealth and capital of Palestine was concentrated in the hands of a few. And the poor struggled more and more, living and dying in really impossibly difficult circumstances. Herod's masterpiece, his most colossal and exorbitantly expensive and astonishingly grandiose building project of all, was the temple in Jerusalem. He built it to honor this god who had led the people out of slavery in Egypt, where they were building temples for the pharaohs. It was an attempt to prove his legitimacy as the ruler of God's people, as a divinely chosen king. If he built a temple to this god, surely this god must be on his side. Herod planned and built a temple that would far surpass the temple that Solomon built. And it was a feat of engineering. It's built out of these many, many ton pieces, huge pieces of marble, and they're stacked one on another. You can't even slide a piece of paper between them, and they don't have any mortar. It is a masterpiece. People, even today, don't know quite how they did it. It had running water. It had a sewage system, paved roads. It could accommodate up to 1 million people. And the white marble and gold leaf walls were said to be so brilliant when the sun was out that you couldn't look directly at them without being blinded. So, in the days before Mary gave birth, she and her betrothed husband Joseph walked 90 miles from Nazareth to Bethlehem in order to comply with a royal decree. The emperor of Rome had demanded that all citizens report and be counted, and so, despite the back-breaking weight of a full-term baby in her belly, Mary and Joseph walked. The place where she gave birth would likely have been open to the night sky, a cave or a courtyard, maybe an animal pen that was underneath a family's mud brick home. And from that place, or from any place in Bethlehem, Mary and Joseph would have been able to look up and see on a hill over Bethlehem the lights of the Herodium. This was a lavish fortress palace that Herod built. It was a safe house for himself in case there was ever an armed uprising. And he used it as a personal retreat for himself and his friends. And it was on this hill overlooking Bethlehem. And so in the shadow of Herod's extravagant and elaborately defended vacation home, this insurgent king was born. You would think by this time in the story, 500 years after the Babylonian exile, that the promise of an heir to the throne of David would have died out. But it didn't. There were still people, Simeon and Anna and Mary among them, who were waiting and praying and longing for this God-sent deliverer king. They're still putting their hope in the day when God would provide a new David, someone with ferocious courage, fierce resolve, who could overthrow their oppressors, someone with wisdom and integrity, who would lead them as a people into a life that reflected together God's reign of justice and peace and love. Now, Mary, from any conventional point of view, is an extremely unlikely mother for Israel's king. She was about as poor and powerless as you could get in her society, except maybe if you were enslaved. And if we were to look in our society, in our community, for someone of a similar social status or economic or political vulnerability, we'd be looking for someone who lives at or below the poverty line, someone whose family makes their living through hard physical labor, someone who is especially vulnerable to exploitation because of their legal status or their race or their family background. If Gabriel showed up in Harrisonburg this week, he might surprise Mary by greeting her in the midst of her job, scrubbing motel rooms or cutting chicken at the poultry plant, her head draped in a hoodie, crowned by box braids. Or maybe the angel would speak with a middle schooler named Miriam, whose small hijabed shoulders are carrying the weight of both traditional caregiving and homekeeping responsibilities, but also this new responsibility of translating and negotiating for her family in an unfamiliar language and culture. Or maybe Gabriel would seek out Maria, a girl who dreams at night of the home she hasn't seen since childhood, but also has nightmares about the trauma she experienced on the journey north and lives with the fear every day of the possibility of a deportation order. From a political, historic, economic point of view, Mary of Nazareth is a nobody. She is someone who could disappear from the face of the earth forever, and the only people who would notice and grieve her loss are her family and her fiancé, maybe a few neighbors. To the powerful and wealthy of her day, she was disposable, expendable, invisible. And then, in addition to all this, she lacks the one thing you would think is pretty essential in becoming the mother of the heir to David's throne: a clear, uncontested family line that you can trace right back to King David. God, through Luke, does not seem very interested in Mary's ancestry or family tree. God is interested in Mary, in her integrity, in her wholeness of heart, in her fierce and uncompromising longing for this day of God's reign of peace. He is interested in her unreserved hope in the God of Israel. You, Gabriel tells her, you are resplendent. You are shining with God's beauty. You are beloved by God. And this time it is God who asks, Mary, will you be a dwelling place for God? Will you welcome the Holy One of Israel into the shelter of your own body? Will you bear God into the world? It turns out that God is not interested in houses made of massive Lebanese cedar beams or colossal gold leaf marble blocks. God is interested in taking up residence among people who have an insatiable longing for the world set right. God is interested in making a home among people who have no pretenses that they can bring about any kind of lasting change under their own power, but who are ready when God asks to say yes. God is seeking a home among people who may be invisible to the powerful and successful, but who, if you have eyes to see, if you pause to look, are shining with a beauty so bright that you can't even bear to look at them directly. God isn't interested in fortresses and power palaces. God is interested in finding shelter and nurture, a home in the vulnerable and undefended body of a girl who, despite all the risks, is willing to say, "Yes, yes, yes, let it be." God's invitation to Mary, it's not just an invitation to carry the Christ child as if this child could remain somehow separate from her. This is an invitation for her life, her love, to be transformed by this child. Given the brutality and the violence that she lived with every day, Mary had to know she was taking an enormous risk. It isn't just that Joseph could abandon her, that she could potentially suffer the consequences of being seen as an unwed young woman. It's that this child who she's welcoming into her womb, into her life, into her love, might well be crushed to death under this powerful military empire. And even so, Mary says, "Yes, yes, let it be to me, let it be now." Mary welcomes this Christ child into her body, into her life. And she sings this song, the Magnificat, in response to this new life growing within her. The Magnificat is a song of political and spiritual revolution. It's an enthronement song for a new king. It's a song that heralds a new reign coming through the God who dwells among us. I was startled to discover as I was researching for this sermon that there are several modern day administrations in recent history who have actually banned the words of the Magnificat because it is so powerful that they were threatened by it. One of those was the British colonial administration in the 1800s in India who decided to take it out of their evensong service. And on the day that the British flags were lowered over India to signal their withdrawal, Gandhi commanded or asked that the Magnificat be read every place that the flag was lowered. This is a song of praise to a God who hears the cry of the poor and acts on their behalf. It's a song of praise to a God who heard the cry of the slaves in Egypt, who heard the weeping of the exiles in Babylon, and who has heard and answered the prayers of teenage girls and elderly widows living in Palestine. This is a God who will not be contained in a house made by human hands, but who will seek shelter in the womb of a very young, very poor, very vulnerable woman. Mary declares that she is blessed, not because this work of welcoming God isn't costly, it is costly, but because the one she has waited for and longed for has come to her, has come in her, has come through her, has come now. The invitation to give that God gave to Mary is an invitation that God gives to us as well, to become a dwelling place for God, to bear God into the world, in our bodies, in our lives, in our hearts. This story of Advent tells us that when the reign of God appears, when our world is radically turned upside down, is reshaped by God's love and justice and peace, when that day comes, when there are no longer the oppressors and the oppressed, but only justice seekers living side by side, on that day, it will not come through emperors or kings or presidents or wealthy entrepreneurs. There will be no royal decrees. There will be no battalions of tanks in the streets. There will only be God dwelling among the vulnerable, among the poor, among the human, among those who say, "Let it be." God comes to us in our very own fragile, human, vulnerable bodies, in our lives, and in those of our neighbors, even in the bodies and lives of very young, very poor, very vulnerable girls. God's reign comes as we, like Mary, say, yes, 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 let it be. Let it be now.
Thank you for listening to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Our theme music is a setting of John Wesley's text, Jesus, I Believe You're Near, composed by Matt Carlson. Jeremy Nafziger arranged it for strings. To learn more about our congregation or to plan a visit, please check out our website at cmcva.org.